So in our last series, we learned that bread gave civilization calories, and beans gave it protein, olive oil gave it light, and something to cook vegetables in. And today, coffee. Coffee gave civilization somewhere to meet, and a reason to stay awake. Coffee arrived relatively late to what we call Western civilizations. The ancient Greeks didn't have it, the Romans didn't have it, Galileo didn't have it. And historians today don't particularly like the old concept of the Dark Ages, and for a good reason. But I have my own definition. The Dark Ages were simply the period before Western civilization discovered coffee, right? I mean, think about poor Galileo at the University of Padua, staying up at night, looking through his telescope at Jupiter. In 1610, he described four objects orbiting Jupiter, providing some rather inconvenient evidence against the idea that everything in the heavens revolved around the earth. And the poor man had to do it without an espresso machine. Perhaps that was his greatest achievement. Coffee didn't build ancient civilization the way wheat, olive oil, and legumes did. That came much later. But when coffee moved out of Africa, across Arabia, through the Ottoman world, and eventually into Europe, something interesting happened. People didn't just drink it. They gathered around it. Coffee houses became places for conversation, commerce, politics, philosophy, science, gossip, revolution, and presumably a great deal of nonsense. Business was conducted over coffee. Strangers met over coffee. Friends met over coffee. And centuries later, we're still doing it. Today, we're going to follow coffee from a fruit growing on a tree to a beverage that helped wake up civilization. We'll talk about happy goats, the coffee houses, espresso machines, the mocha pot, paper filters, and why the way you make your coffee can actually change its effect on your cholesterol. We'll talk about what caffeine actually does to the brain, whether coffee really raises cortisol, whether you need to wait 90 minutes after waking before you drink it, and why some of the most interesting health effects of coffee may have little to do with caffeine at all. Today, we're going to make sense of the madness of coffee. I am your chief medical explanationist, Dr. Terry Simpson, and this is Fork U, Fork University, where we make sense of the madness, bust a few myths, and teach you a little bit about food and medicine. Like many of you, I begin my day with coffee. And since about 1995, my first cup has almost always involved Pete's Major Dickinson blend. But my relationship with coffee began much earlier. I grew up in Ketchikan, Alaska, a town famous for salmon, fishing, totem poles, and rain. Lots of rain. In particularly wet years, rainfall can approach and exceed 200 inches. Now compare that to Seattle, where we thought was dry, and you all think is wet, which is 39 inches a year, or Portland, which from Ketchikan was practically a desert, and is 36 inches a year. And in Ketchikan, this isn't romantic rain that falls gently outside the window while you sit beside a fireplace reading Hemingway. The rain in Ketchikan comes sideways. The umbrellas are almost always inverted and owned only by tourists. Now, my mother was Norwegian, my father half Athabaskan and Scottish, and like many women of my mother's generation in Ketchikan, she had been brought to Alaska by her husband, willingly because he loved her, and she loved him, unwillingly because that weather is depressing. Now, imagine that for a moment. You're living in a relatively isolated town in southeastern Alaska. Your extended family may be thousands of miles away. Winter days are short. The weather keeps you inside, and sometimes it seems as though the rain hasn't stopped since Eisenhower was president. This was before SSRIs, but there was coffee, and women would get together. You could always go to Betty's house for a cup of coffee, and I remember they would sit around and talk about husbands, children, neighbors, probably about us children, which may explain several things about my childhood, and looking back as a physician, I sometimes think that the coffee table was a form of therapy. Not because caffeine treats depression, it doesn't. But because people do. Conversation does. Friendship does. A self-sustaining community does. And knowing that when the rain is blowing sideways and you've had enough of your family, there's a kitchen table somewhere with another human being or two sitting there can matter enormously. And coffee provided the excuse. Of course, there were standards. Growing up, coffee meant Hills Brothers. And if Betty served some other coffee, it might be consumed gratefully, but it would also be discussed later. Coffee preferences could generate more conversation than differences in religion. And in a place where you could still hear Norwegian spoken on the streets, coffee sometimes felt like our national beverage. Now, admittedly, Ketchikan had considerably more bars than churches, and the bars in Ketchikan did close from the hour of 5 a.m. to 6 a.m. They had to clean up the place, and at 6 a.m., the regular customers would duly be waiting for the bar to reopen. But that's another podcast. At my parents' table, coffee was almost an additive to canned milk and sugar, and Hills Brothers cans were everywhere. You know, in Ketchikan, if you'd go hiking around the island, you would find Hills Brothers cans every place you looked. People always used them. They held nails, screws, fishing gear, whatever needed holding, someone had a coffee can for it. So when I first went to San Francisco in the 1970s and saw the Hills Brothers coffee roasting plant, I didn't think, there's a coffee company. I thought, I found home. And years later, just a little bit south of San Francisco in Ventura, I found my home. But coffee does that. It becomes associated with place, with family, with mornings, with people. And my mother's coffee table in Ketchikan was a part of a tradition much older than any of us realized. No history of coffee is complete without the goats. According to the famous story, an Ethiopian goat herder named Kalidi noticed that his goats became unusually energetic after eating the red fruit from a particular tree. The goats supposedly began dancing. Now Kalidi tried the fruit himself and discovered that he felt rather lively too. Evidently, monks got involved because staying awake during nighttime prayers turns out to be easier when you've discovered caffeine. It's a wonderful story, and there's actually very little evidence that it happened. But I refuse to let historical scholarship deprive us of caffeinated dancing goats. The more defensible history takes us to Ethiopia, where coffee arabica originated, and across the Red Sea to Yemen. By the 15th century, we have good evidence of coffee drinking in Yemen. It became associated in part with the Sufi communities, who appreciated its ability to help people remain alert through nighttime devotions. Maybe if they prayed less and read more, well, that's another story. But from Yemen, coffee traveled along trade routes, along the Arabian Peninsula, into Egypt and the Ottoman Empire. And somewhere along the journey, coffee stopped being merely something people drank, and it became somewhere people went. By the 16th century, coffee houses were flourishing in the Ottoman world. You could sit, talk, hear news, conduct business, play games, argue politics, gossip. In other words, people accomplished most of what we now accomplish on social media, except occasionally they had to look one another in the eye. Coffee moved west to the Mediterranean trade routes. Venice became one of the European gateways, and by the 17th century, coffee houses were spreading through Western Europe. London's first coffee house is generally dated to 1652, and the coffee house became associated with merchants, writers, politicians, scientists, and intellectuals. Some London coffee houses became associated with particular trades and professions. Lloyd's Coffee House, for example, became a meeting place for merchants, ship owners, and people interested in maritime insurance, which eventually gave us Lloyd's of London. Coffee houses were sometimes called penny universities. For the price of a cup, you could sit down, listen, and perhaps learn something. Now, coffee did not cause the Enlightenment. We have to be careful with historical stories that become a little too perfect. But coffee houses certainly provided places where people participating in that enormous exchange of ideas would gather. And unlike the tavern, the principal psychoactive substance being served made people more alert, not less. And that, it seemed, at a minimum, convenient. And then there were the Swedes. Always the Swedes. In 1709, King Charles XII of Sweden lost rather badly to Peter the Great's Russians at the Battle of Pultava. Charles ending up spending years in Ottoman territory, much of it around a place called Bender. Now, being stranded after losing a war has obvious disadvantages, but Charles encountered something the Ottomans already understood extremely well. Coffee. Charles and his entourage became enthusiastic coffee drinkers, and Swedish historical accounts describe extraordinary quantities of coffee consumed by the royal party while they were there. Eventually, coffee and the Swedes returned home, and Charles came with them, and their enthusiasm for coffee obviously came with them. Now, there's also this wonderful story that Charles brought Swedish meatballs home from the Ottoman Empire. That story is considerably harder to establish, but Ottoman influence on Swedish cooking is real. Whether Charles personally brought it home, or as the ancestor of the Swedish meatball, or whether some enterprising Swedes subsequently decided to add pork, I'll leave that to food historians like my friend Simon Majumdar, who have more courage than I do. But the Swedes certainly kept the coffee, and eventually they turned drinking it into something approaching a national treasure. Fika. Fika isn't simply drinking coffee. You stop, you sit, and you usually have something to eat, and more importantly, someone to talk to, which sounds remarkably like my mother's kitchen table in Ketchikan. Now, this may be coffee's most enduring contribution. In many societies, you don't begin just talking business. First comes the coffee. You make the introductions. You ask about family. You talk about where they're from. You establish that the person sitting opposite of you is another human being, and you bond. Then, and only then, do you conduct business. Now, in America, typically we have streamlined that process, perhaps not for the better. We usually pick up our paper cups from the espresso bar, carry them into the conference room, open up the laptop, and announce that we have a hard stop at 11. We've kept the coffee. We've occasionally misplaced the ritual. But something interesting is happening again. Coffee shops have become social spaces, and while alcohol consumption, particularly among younger people, which is anybody younger than me by 10 years, has been declining. And for generations, America socializing often meant, let's get a drink, usually the alcohol variety. But increasingly today, that drink is coffee. From a health standpoint, replacing some alcohol with coffee is a trade worth making. A healthier drink, a brighter mind, because human beings like to meet around beverages. Now, for some cultures, it's tea, for others, it's coffee. I remember growing up in Alaska and hearing that the British would put leaves into a perfectly good hot water when coffee existed. Ironically, today, I actually drink iced tea throughout the day, but apparently, the British eventually got to me. And I understand in the modern dating world, some first dates now happen at coffee houses rather than over dinner and wine. Some people object. They think a proper first date should involve dinner. I'm not convinced. If I'm going to spend 2 hours discovering if I like someone, wouldn't I rather find out what they're like after they've occupied their adenosine receptors in their brain? More about that later. Give them an espresso, let's hear their interpretation of Hume. Although if your first coffee dates began with an extended discussion of an inquiry concerning human understanding, there may not be a second date. So, don't ask me for dating advice. Eventually, humans decided that simply roasting coffee, grinding it, and pouring water over it wasn't sufficient. We needed machinery. And then in 1884, a man in Turin patented an early steam-driven machine designed to prepare coffee rapidly. In 1901, another one developed a machine that could prepare individual servings, and then commercialized it. We're beginning the approach of espresso. In 1908, a German woman named Benz got tired of grounds and bitterness in her coffee and experimented with paper filtration. Now remember that paper, because we're going to get back to it. In 1933, Alfonso Belletti introduced the Mocha Express, a wonderful little octagonal aluminum stovetop brewer that has become an icon of the Italian kitchen. Also during the 1930s, a man by the name of Francisco Illi in Trieste developed Illetta, another important step in pressure-based coffee. By the way, Trieste has some of the most interesting hard water in the world that takes the bitterness away from coffee. The only other place you can find hard water like that? Phoenix and Scottsdale, Arizona. In 1948, another man found a lever system that helped us give us that high-pressure extraction and crema we recognize in the modern espresso. Meanwhile, America developed a different philosophy about coffee. More. Percolators, diners, large cups. Someone walking around filling your cup before you even finished it, and not charging you for another cup. The Italian stood at a bar and drank an ounce of espresso and moved on. The American sat at a diner while someone named Flo kept refilling 12 ounces until you surrendered. You probably have seen that Chemex, that beautiful thing that looks like an Erlenmeyer flask, that was developed in 1941. Look at a Chemex sometime. It is laboratory glassware. It's a glass vessel, a wooden collar, and a paper filter. And as someone who spent a fair amount of time in chem labs, I approve and, of course, oddly, own one. And there's that paper again. And we're going to discover that paper wasn't simply keeping grounds out of your teeth. It changed the chemistry of what you drink. Before we get there, though, we need to talk about the drug everyone thinks is an important part of coffee. Now, my first introduction to caffeine wasn't from coffee. It was from tea. In organic chemistry lab at the University of Chicago, we isolated caffeine from tea. To accomplish this, we essentially brewed what may have been the world's strongest cup of tea. It looked completely undrinkable, which was fine. We weren't trying to enjoy the afternoon tea. We were trying to extract a molecule. And I thought, oh my God, this tea is undrinkable. And then years later, my aforementioned friend Simon Majumdar introduced me to what he called proper British builder's tea. Now I understand what strong tea is, what tea with ambition is. Builder's tea is approximately one step away from containing enough caffeine to keep you awake through an entire episode of this podcast. And the molecule doing that work is caffeine. Now, in the brain, caffeine predominantly works by antagonizing what we call adenosine receptors. Adenosine signaling contributes to sleep pressure. As the day goes on, you've been awake longer, that signaling is a part of what tells your brain, hey, maybe it's time to stop doing that and go to bed. Caffeine doesn't manufacture energy per se. It doesn't recharge your mitochondria. It doesn't sprinkle vitality over your neurons. It interferes with one of the signals telling your brain that you're tired, which is why caffeine makes you feel more alert. It's also why drinking it late in the day can sometimes interfere with sleep, and why people who drink several cups of coffee and suddenly stop may discover that their brain objects with a rather impressive headache. Which brings me to one of the internet's favorite coffee rules. People who say, don't drink coffee for 90 minutes after you wake up. Why, you might ask? And they will say, cortisol, that hormone that every influencer that doesn't know, well, shall we say, bullshit from Shinola. Well, anyway, but while it turns out there is a little bit of legitimate physiology underneath this claim, caffeine can acutely stimulate something called ACTH and cortisol. And controlled studies have found that measurable increases of cortisol occur after caffeine consumption. All right, so far so good. But this is where social media does something remarkable. A physiologic observation becomes a commandment. The argument goes that cortisol naturally surges when you wake up. Therefore, caffeine during this period is redundant, perhaps harmful, and you should therefore wait 90 minutes before drinking coffee. That would make me a homicidal maniac, by the way. But we don't have any randomized clinical trials demonstrating that people who wait 90 minutes have better alertness, better cortisol preferences or profiles, better sleep, better metabolic health, or better long-term outcomes. And by the way, if you're a habitual caffeine drinker, you will develop a substantial tolerance to the caffeine-cortisol effect, meaning it won't affect your cortisol one bit. So that response is seen in someone who rarely drinks caffeine. But that isn't the response of someone who's been drinking Hill's Brothers or Pete's every morning since Eisenhower was president, or Carter, or whatever generation you guys have. Recent research has even complicated the tidy social media picture of the cortisol awakening response itself. Human physiology, inconveniently, tends to be messier than an infographic. So, does caffeine affect cortisol? Yes. Does that prove you need to wait 90 minutes before drinking coffee? Thankfully, no. And that's an important distinction in medicine. A mechanism is not a clinical outcome. If waiting 90 minutes makes you feel better, wonderful, wait. But if you've been drinking your coffee shortly after waking up for however many years, and you're sleeping well, and your blood pressure is fine, and you're enjoying your morning cup, there is no compelling evidence that you need to stand beside your coffee maker with the stopwatch. Now here's what makes coffee a little more interesting. Coffee isn't caffeine dissolved in brown water. Well, maybe at some places it is. For years, medicine tended to think about coffee primarily in terms of caffeine. Caffeine stimulates. Caffeine can transiently increase your blood pressure. It can increase your heart rate. and therefore people decided caffeine must be bad for your heart. Except coffee simply isn't caffeine dissolved in brown water. Coffee contains hundreds of compounds, and among the ones we're particularly interested in are something called chlorogenic acids, an important family of polyphenols. There's a number of them that are in there, and roasting transforms the chemistry again and creates other compounds, and so coffee becomes that interesting food matrix. And when researchers stopped asking why, only what caffeine does over the next 60 minutes, and began asking what happens to people who drink coffee for decades, the story changed. Now, some of the early observational studies made coffee drinkers look unhealthy, but coffee drinkers in those studies did something else. They smoked. Cigarettes and coffee were cultural companions for decades in the United States. Once researchers became better at separating smoking and other behaviors from coffee consumption, the cardiovascular story changed. Large studies and subsequent large analysis have repeatedly found that moderate habitual coffee consumption is not associated with worse heart disease, and it is associated with a lower all-cause mortality from heart disease, meaning less deaths from heart disease the more you drink coffee. Type 2 diabetes is consistently lower among habitual coffee drinkers, and intriguingly, some of these associations appear among people also drinking decaffeinated coffee, which means caffeine cannot be the entire explanation. Now let me emphasize something. These are predominantly observational studies. We did not randomize hundreds of thousands of people to coffee or no coffee and follow them for 30 years to see who dies first. Association is not causation. Coffee drinkers may differ from non-coffee drinkers in ways that are difficult to measure. Well, let's just say I don't associate with non-coffee drinkers, so I have no opinion about that other than that one. But when large studies across different populations repeatedly point in similar directions, and we have plausible biologic mechanisms supporting those observations, the evidence becomes interesting. At minimum, the old idea that coffee is obviously an unhealthy vice becomes a difficult one to defend. And then there's the liver. Coffee and the liver. This may be one of the most consistent medical signals associated with coffee. Habitual coffee consumption is associated with lower risk of chronic liver disease, fibrosis, scarring, cirrhosis, liver cancer, and liver-related death. The signal has appeared repeatedly across large observational studies, and again, some benefit appears to continue with decaffeinated coffee, and that matters, because it points us back toward those other compounds in coffee, including the chlorogenic acids and the polyphenols, rather than attributing everything to caffeine. There are plausible mechanisms involving glucose metabolism, oxidative stress, and inflammatory pathways, but notice what I'm not saying. I'm not saying coffee is medicine. I'm not prescribing 4 cups of coffee for cirrhosis, and I'm certainly not suggesting you purchase a bottle of purified chlorogenic acid because somebody on Instagram recently discovered a biochemical pathway. We observe the outcomes. Then we investigate the mechanisms that might help explain them, not the other way around. That's science, after all. We're not shirtless salesmen of supplements and scams. Now remember Melitta's paper? Let's go back to 1908, because paper filters turn out to matter. Coffee contains other chemicals, and one of those chemicals, called caffstol, can increase LDL cholesterol. But the amount that reaches your cup depends heavily upon how you brew the coffee. Boiled coffee retains more, French press retains more, espresso contains some, although the serving size is small, but paper filtration removes much of it. Which means that Melitta Bentz wasn't simply solving a problem of coffee grounds. She inadvertently changed the metabolic composition of the beverage. That is culinary medicine. Same bean, same hot water, different preparation, different chemistry. And this is particularly amusing to someone whose mother was Norwegian, because traditional Scandinavian boiled coffee isn't exactly the brewing method I'd choose if lowering LDL were my typical objective. Apparently, even Scandinavians need some improvement. Well, they didn't win the World Cup this year, so I think that's clear to everybody. Coffee, though, is not for everyone. that doesn't mean that everybody, you know, all these great things doesn't mean you should be drinking coffee, because some people do get palpitations of their heart. Some people report they get anxious or jittery. Some people develop heartburn or reflux. Some can't sleep if you have caffeine afternoon. My father would drink a cup of coffee so he could go to sleep. But most people can't do that. And some people metabolize caffeine faster than others. Pregnancy has its own recommendations about caffeine intake. And if your coffee consists of a little espresso underneath an enormous quantities of syrup, whipped cream, and sugar, we're no longer studying coffee. We're studying dessert with a caffeine delivery system. For most adults, though, moderate coffee consumption fits very well into a healthy diet. And if you're concerned about your low-density lipoprotein, your LDL, or the so-called bad cholesterol, really a horrible name for it, we don't use it anymore, paper-filtered coffee has an advantage over drinking large amounts of unfiltered coffee. So after all of this, how do I make mine? Now, I know this might surprise you, but I have more coffee machines than Carter has pills. But since 2005, most of my coffee comes from a machine which is made by Jura. By the way, I'm on my second Jura machine, and between the two of them, I have made over 30,000 cups of coffee. And that first morning cup is still generally Pete's Major Dickinson's blend. And for years when I traveled, I carried an AeroPress. You know, hotels can be trusted with the bed, the towels, the elevators, and the structural integrity of the building, but I simply couldn't trust them with coffee. I wanted a proper cup when I wake up. Some hotels you have to call room service. Oh my God. Oh, by the way, today I also have an espresso machine in my bedroom. Yep, my bedroom. Because some mornings I don't particularly want to leave my room. Sometimes it's when my son has friends here and they're upstairs, way too loud for my morning meditations. Sometimes I'd rather make coffee, stay in bed, and read another half hour before civilization requires my participation, and maybe that's appropriate. Because after all, the chemistry, epidemiology, and arguments over cortisol, I think we sometimes forget why humanity fell in love with coffee in the first place. Coffee woke up civilization. My mother and the other women sitting around those kitchen tables in Ketchikan weren't discussing chlorogenic acids. The Swedes weren't performing randomized clinical controlled trials during Fika. The merchants of the London coffee houses weren't measuring their cortisol. And the Sufis drinking coffee in Yemen weren't worried about whether 90 minutes had passed since they woke up. They drank coffee because it made them alert, because it tasted good, because it was warm, and because someone else was sitting across the table. And that's the part I keep coming back to. On a dark, rainy day in Ketchikan, when the rain was blowing sideways, and perhaps life in Alaska wasn't quite what someone had imagined when she followed her husband north, there was always Betty's house, and there was coffee, and someone to talk to. And maybe that wasn't medicine, but I wouldn't underestimate it. Today we have antidepressants, therapists, and much more sophisticated understanding of mental health. But we still need Betty's kitchen table. We still need Fika. We still need the coffee house. And we still need a friend who says, come on over, I'll put the coffee on. Bread gave civilization calories. Beans gave it protein. Olive oil gave us light and something delicious to put fish and vegetables into. But coffee gave us an alertness. But perhaps the greatest contribution wasn't the caffeine. It gave us a reason to sit down together. And sometimes, after we sat together long enough, we get back up with a slightly brighter mind. Coffee didn't build civilization, it did wake us up. And every once in a while, it made civilization sit down and talk. And tomorrow morning, it will wake me up too. Please check out the blog associated with this at forkyou.com. And for more information and more in-depth information about this, you can see it on my Substack, which can be found at drsimpson.com. This has been researched by me, Dr. Simpson, and while I am a board-certified physician, I am not your physician. For medical advice or changes in your diet, please see a real board-certified physician and/or a registered dietitian. Do not see a chiropractor. Do not see an Eastern-trained or integrative physician, because they're mainly witch doctors, in my not-so-humble opinion. See a real doctor. All things audio are done by my friends at Simpler Media and the pod god himself, Mr. Evo Terra. Producer Girl Productions make me sound far better than I am. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a good week. Hey, Ivo, when you meet someone for coffee, is the coffee actually the point, or is coffee one of civilization's best excuses to sit across from another human being and talk? And I know, by the way, you used to be an AeroPress user. Still your favorite form of machine? Oh, and by the way, what are the better coffee houses in Phoenix these days? When I get back, I'd love to meet you at one. Hi to Sheila.
Coffee is a great way to have meetings, no doubt about that. Yes, I am still a hardcore user of my AeroPress, long shall it rain, and Copper Star Coffee here in the Melrose District remains my favorite coffee place, so when you get here, that's where we're going. Cheers.